Hello, welcome to The Musics in Japan,
a conversational podcast about daily life for an American couple living long-term in Japan.
So lately I've been thinking about raising kids in Japan.
We already raised one.
Yes. So the first time, because we had planned to come to Japan when he was 8, and I came over and I was studying Japanese, and I was going to study Japanese and then be fluent in Japanese, and you were going to come over after you graduated from Berkeley.
Right.
But then I got sick, which is a topic for a different episode. And so it took us about 3 years from then to get back. And so we came over when he was 12, and he had graduated high school at 12. So he wasn't actually in any formal education at that time.
That's right. And soon after, we put him back in formal education.
Yeah, he went to college online and graduated college from university when he was 16.
Yes.
So for me, the biggest challenge for raising him in Japan was the fact that he wasn't bilingual, and how to get him socialized and a peer group and learn Japanese.
Yeah, that was a trick.
And also because since he had already graduated high school, we couldn't just send him to an international school, which there are quite a few international schools in Nagoya.
But the thing about them is that none of them are actually accredited by the Japanese government.
Correct.
They have accreditations other places, you know, through the U.S., one of the regionals, or through the, you know, international organizations, the IBO or whatever. But in Japan, they have the same status as driving school.
Yeah.
So there's been some discussion lately in the news about whether sending your kid to one of these schools, they're actually in violation of truancy laws.
Yeah. And a lot of Japanese universities won't accept diplomas from them.
Right.
Won't count them as high school graduates. And so we can kind of get around that with testing into college and all of that.
Yeah.
So for us, him already being a high school graduate, which we were really happy about because we didn't want to put him into Japanese high school because he didn't speak Japanese. And we didn't want to put him in an international high school because we didn't feel there was a big enough benefit for the price tag.
Right.
And so having him already graduate was really nice because in our home state of California, you're able to take a test and graduate high school.
Yeah, it's a little bit more complicated than that. You have to be at least a 10th grader to take that test. But if you're homeschooled, which you have to file a declaration form to do, then you get to decide what grade the kid is in.
Yeah.
So we just, when he was 11, we said, yeah, he's a 10th grader.
Well, we also homeschooled him, and he did have all of that because he went to
private school.
So don't say that we just like decided he was a 10th grader.
No. We looked at what he would need to know for the test. So he did well on the test. He passed it easily.
Yes.
So,
but he also had all of the math, language, writing, and reading skills of a 10th grader.
Correct.
When he went in. And when he entered college, he had all of, at 12, he had all of the math, reading skills that he needed to take all college level classes. He didn't take any remedial classes.
No, he didn't. And in fact, he would get frustrated sometimes. He'd be like, okay, so I'm in my, I think it was like, history class or philosophy or something. And this person is just totally plagiarized. You can tell it's just from Wikipedia. What do I do about that? Who do I tell on them to?
Yes. He was very much the plagiarist. He did not like plagiarism at all.
Because he'd say, I worked really hard writing my discussion posts and other people are just plagiarizing. That's just not fair.
Yeah, he really wanted it to be fair. He had an extreme sense of social justice and wanting things to be balanced and fair when he was 12 and 13 years old.
Mm.
Now he's really a lot more laid back. He's like, I don't care what other people are doing. But back then he cared quite a bit.
Well, I think because he just really disliked it.
Yeah.
Not just people cheating. He disliked school, too.
Yes, he did.
And it was like, I went through your test. I did your test to graduate from high school. Why should I have to do more school?
Like, well, because with a bachelor's degree, you can, and this is a benefit of being from a country that's recognized as an English-speaking country.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as you have a bachelor's degree, you can get a visa to teach English anywhere in Asia.
Yes.
And South America and many places in Europe.
Well, and the other thing is that the way that you can graduate from high school early in California is not universally recognized. So it's California law that it's equivalent to a high school diploma.
But it was recognized, it would have been recognized in Japan. But then he wouldn't have the 10 years of education that Japan likes.
Right.
And so that's where it kind of gets funky for Japan, is that a high school diploma or 10 years of education.
Right.
And he didn't have 10 years at that point. So having the him earning his bachelor's, he would be able to, at 16, sponsor his own visa if he got a job, which we did not have him do.
No, he would have had to wait till 18 just because of their rules on age. But
so would he have to wait till 20?
No, for some reason, 18. So 20 is the age of legal adulthood in Japan.
Yeah.
But if it's immigration related, then it's 18. So it's a weird kind of schism there.
Yeah.
But I mean, I grew up in Alaska where the legal age of majority is 18, but you couldn't smoke until you're 19, couldn't drink until you're 21, but you could join the military at 16. So it's, you know,
yeah,
different legal ages for different things.
So something I found, the three things that I found most challenging about raising a child in Japan for me, one was socialization. The other was language acquisition, second language acquisition. And the third was shifting timelines and expectations.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to start with shifting timelines and expectations, because that's kind of the most relevant for right now, what we just recently did. So if we had stayed in the United States, I had always planned to enroll him in driver's ed, teach him how to drive myself for the gap between driver's ed and teaching how to drive.
Right.
And driver's ed would be offered through whatever high school he went to.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would give him my car.
Right.
So it was all relatively inexpensive. I would buy myself a new car, just really straightforward, knew how to do everything. It all made sense. This would happen when he was 16. And I felt really good about that plan. It's very close to my own story, because at 16, I learned how to drive and I got my car and all of that. So I got my driver's license on my 16th birthday, and I really wanted to have that same experience for him. But there's no, it doesn't culturally translate. And because Japan drives on the left-hand side of the road, I do not feel qualified to teach him to drive.
Mm-hmm.
And I let my California driver's license expire before getting my international driver's license. So now I do not have a driver's license in Japan, because I believe, for me personally, and this is my personal belief, which has changed, I felt 5 years ago that you shouldn't drive unless you're fluent in the language of the country you're driving in.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you get in accidents with other drivers, you need to be able to exchange information. You need to be able to talk with them. And when the police come, you need to be able to advocate and convince them that it wasn't your fault.
So if you're listening, hoping to move to Japan and get a driver's license, Google how to do it. Don't take our advice. But basically, you have to get an international driver's license before you come. And then you have to convert it within 1 year to a Japanese.
Unless you're from Maryland. So this is something true. I did look it up. I don't know if it'll still be true whenever they come, but look it up. But
oh, the transcript is going to say skeptical look.
Japan views every state license in the United States differently.
Well, they all have different requirements, yeah.
Yeah, so if you get a Maryland license, you can transfer that directly to a Japanese license. You don't have to do international.
Interesting, because the international driver's license is just an application form. So I've never quite understood why it's given any weight, but you know, whatever.
And so for me, if I also feel it being, because I, when I ride in cars, I still flinch even after being here for over 10 years.
Uh-huh.
I still flinch on right-hand and left-hand turns. It still feels wrong to me. Pulling out of my instincts and my muscle memory is very much to driving on the right-hand side of the road.
You know, I'm always headed for the driver's side whenever I ride with somebody, because I'm like heading in my mind for the passenger side. And then I see the steering wheel, I'm like, right, yep, nope, got to sit on the other side.
Yeah, so for me, I'm better at now knowing how to get in on the passenger side.
Uh-huh.
And that's because our son has a car and he's always driving me around places. So I ride in cars a lot more frequently than I did in the past. Whew. So I'm having a hot flash. If you hear me fanning, I apologize, but whew, doggy. This yes. menopause is like, menopause is real.
It is.
The hot flashes are real, man. They're something else. They're something else.
Many years later.
Yes, because I did have the, what's it called, surgical...
Surgical menopause,
yeah. I went through surgical menopause because I had a hysterectomy, which makes me suspicious. Like, you know, I've always wondered, like, what exactly did they take out and what exactly did they leave in?
Mm-hmm.
But that's a completely different episode. Back to raising a child and shifting timelines. So for me, everything shifted, like prom. So for me, prom would be like... a serious girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
And prom happens your junior year of high school. So that's age 16. You get your serious girlfriend. You get a car. You probably become sexually active. Not promoting that. Not saying 16 is the age that you should. Just saying that car culture in the United States, a lot of teenagers have sex in cars. And so if you give your teenager a car, I feel like, I don't know, for me, emotionally, you need to be prepared for the fact that they might be having sex.
Yeah. If you don't like that, give them a convertible.
No, even with the convertible, you can still do it. You can still do it. If you're lithe and nimble and all of that. Cause
they give them a motorcycle. Because yeah. That's what teenagers need.
So I'm not saying that I'm like, I was wanting our son to have sex
right.
at 16. I'm glad he didn't. Because he didn't have sex at 16. I think in large part because he didn't have a car.
Probably, yeah.
What do you think about that?
He didn't have a car. He didn't have his own place. He wasn't old enough to rent a hotel room.
Yeah.
So, like, he had no way to kind of get away with it. And Japanese apartments are small enough that we would have noticed somebody else coming in.
Yeah, and there was no way to, like, climb up a trellis or anything because we live on one of the top floors of our building.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So what do you feel about the shift? Because I feel like us living in Japan, and this was one of the things that appealed to me for living in Japan. I felt like he would kiss later, have sex later, get a car later. I felt like everything just happened later in life.
Well, and that's one of the things we're looking at when we moved is the climate in the U.S. school systems. I mean, he went to a good school, but there was still violence in schools. And when we looked at Japan, it wasn't like Japan was better. You know, the time
that... But for the drugs, Japan was a lot better because
right.
even the private school that he was at, there was an Adderall issue.
Yeah.
People using, abusing Adderall. And in the public school system, we lived in a really nice neighborhood, really great public school, but there was still, we couldn't find a school that didn't have a drug problem at the time that we were looking
yeah.
and thinking about him going to high school.
Well, and I know that when I went to high school back like in the late 80s, early 90s, the high school I went to took like all the kids from the military base plus kids who lived in town and had like problems with marijuana. And then the other high school took all the rich kids and had problems with cocaine. So like whichever high school you went to, there was drugs readily available.
So I went to like 3 or 4 high schools and every single high school that I went to, massive massive drugs.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, though, the one high school that I went to that was like straight up ghetto, just like hood to me,
uh-huh.
the only thing that you could get on campus there was marijuana. And the most ritzy high school I went to, you could get everything. You can get acid, mushrooms, like a whole cornucopia
yeah, of
illegal drugs.
So I went to Lathrop High School, which used to be called Fairbanks Main High School. And so I think that had a population of students that was relatively representative of the general U.S. population. It was like, I think like between 15 and 20% of the kids were black, like 10 and 20% were Asian, and it was like probably half the kids were white. And it was just marijuana. That was it. But the other high school was like 97% white and 3% Asian. There were like 2 black kids.
Mm-hmm.
At that high school, and they had like serious problems with cocaine and with prescription drug abuse.
And so the high school that I went to that was predominantly African American, it was just weed. Mm-hmm. There wasn't like anything harder. It was just not on campus, not available on campus.
Yeah.
Now I ventured off campus and got, you know, harder stuff because I did a lot of drugs in my youth. Don't do drugs. Stay in school.
But it was interesting. So I know there's a digression, but we'd be off brand if we didn't have one.
Yeah.
The high school that I went to, they would write about it in the newspaper. And I wrote to the editor, a letter to the editor of the newspaper at the time, because I was, there was one day that they had an issue. On one page, it said, Lathrop students flock to nearby mall and loot as shoplifters, or something like that. Like, it was all about how terrible it was to be near our high school because we would just like mob the mall, and there were so many of us, they couldn't stop us from shoplifting. And then in the column over from that was like, West Valley Junior High School champions. It was consistently like that. Like, there'd be, Lathrop is just awful, the kids are awful, they're all thieves and vandals, and West Valley, oh, we love our rich kids.
Okay. That kind of discrimination and propaganda and bias. Yeah. Yeah, that's too bad.
But the information that we got before we came here about Japanese high schools, and one of the reasons that we pushed to get Ross to graduate from high school was, like, you know,
they were setting
kids on fire. Yeah.
That was bullying.
Bullying was big one, but like setting kids on fire was the one I remember.
Because they have the senpai kohai system where you have like upperclassmen and lowerclassmen, and the lowerclassmen have to do whatever the upperclassmen say. And the year that we moved here, that was the year that three different kids in three different neighborhoods were set on fire.
Yeah.
By older, like legit set on fire. So it also happens in California. There was that same year, there was a story about a kid who, a young man who wore a skirt to school and got set on fire for that.
Yeah.
So that is just alarming. You know, yeah. When you hear that in high school people are setting people on fire, I was like, whoa,
okay,
wait a minute, pump please. The brakes.
Don't set anybody on fire, ever. But right. If you're going to set fires, wait till you're in university.
Don't set fires. So for school, I was really worried about bullying. And then, because of the homogeneity in Japan, it's predominantly Japanese. And so there aren't a lot of foreigners, and there aren't a lot of points of contact for blackness specifically.
Right.
And there is a problem in Japan with blackface and cultural appropriation and appropriating the most negative stereotypes. Like, there is a Japanese group that calls themselves the niggas, N-I-G-G-A-Z. And they dress, interestingly enough, they appropriate Chicano fashion. So they're dressed like cholos and cholas, but they call themselves the niggas, and they rap. So that's a problem. And then every New Year's Eve, there's a issue with somebody appearing on TV in blackface.
Yeah.
And so I don't think that Japan understands. And there's also, like, in Nagoya, there's like lowrider clubs where they celebrate lowriders, and they dress like cholos and cholas, and they like have religious artifacts and things for religions that they don't believe in, for customs that they don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Japanese really kind of view other cultures as costumes,
right?
And don't really dive. This isn't everybody, but there is an issue with this in Japan where it's just a costume.
Definitely. You know, I wonder if part of it is that I think something like 30% of the Japanese export economy is cultural stuff.
Yeah.
So, I mean, cars is a big one. But after that, like, anime and movies and stuff makes Japan massive amounts of money to export it. So,
yes.
Like, Japanese people generally don't seem to have an issue with cultural appropriation. Like, if other people want to appropriate Japanese culture, they're like, yes, we're selling it, please buy.
Yeah. And they actually want it. So they're like, yes, cool, come over, dress up like a samurai, cool, wear a shirt with kanji you don't know how to read, get kanji tattoos that you don't know how to read.
Right.
And it doesn't seem to make Japanese nationals angry. There are some Japanese nationals that it makes angry, but generally speaking,
right,
it's not as sensitive a topic as it is in the United States.
And, you know, I wouldn't feel upset if, like, somebody outside the U.S. were, like, wearing a t-shirt with a hamburger on it. Like, yeah, I'm American. I've got a hamburger.
So for me, I have a problem with any variation of the N-word being used. Yeah. I just feel like that's not your word. You don't get to use that word. So please don't use that word. And I feel like any images, any slave imagery, I have a problem with. I don't have a problem with like makeup and hairstyles. I know for some people it's very upsetting if people who are not, who don't have African ancestry wear dreadlocks.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't bother me as much. Cornrows doesn't bother me as much. It does bother me when there's black fishing, where they're trying to pass as black, or they know that they're being perceived as black, and they don't correct people and say, yo, you know, this is what my culture is. Although I think black is beautiful, this isn't my ancestry, and just differentiating. And that's only because there's a limited amount of opportunities for African Americans and for people with African ancestry, and I want those limited opportunities to go to those people.
I think it goes deeper than that too, because I know I come from a writing side of it, and I know that, you know, whenever somebody writes a book about the black experience, that short-sightedly kind of takes up space for other books about the black experience. And what I've seen happen is that somebody who's usually white will write a book about what it's like to be black. And then when somebody who's actually black comes and writes a book about it, they get told, no, that's not what it's like. It's like this other book. And I see that more on a personal level with disability stuff.
But you wrote a book where the main character is a black female in a wheelchair.
Absolutely.
And you draw from your understanding of what that means from my experience.
I do. So when I say about the black experience,
so for the black portion of it, just to be clear, I'm not in a wheelchair. We have other sources for that. You personally knew a young lady who was in a wheelchair, and you based a lot on her experience, and we also have a lot of connections.
I have writing groups, so I had several people who are wheelchair users read it. I did some paid sensitivity reads, but when I was writing that, I wasn't saying to myself, I'm writing the black experience. I was writing a book with a black character, and made the gaze very clear. So I think a lot about gaze, and I think that the same thing happens with the Japanese culture, where they're like looking at it as, no, this is me, rather than this is my perception of that culture.
Yeah. But this is like a complete digression. We need to get back to raising a kid.
Okay.
Raising a young... Okay,
yeah, he will never grow up if we don't get back to it.
So he has an afro, which I think is beautiful. And raising him in Japan versus raising him in the United States as an afro wearer, as someone who celebrates their natural hair, I didn't find any issues any differences between what I would have done in the United States versus what I would have done in Japan, with the exception of in Japan, I have to cut his hair.
Yeah.
There's no one in Nagoya. And we recently... He went to a barber who, like, not a single part of his hair is the same length. There are so many dips and curls, and some parts of it were so short that we just had to camouflage that until it grows out and we can even out the length.
Yeah,
so it's still being repaired from that.
So Ross is completely bilingual. So he asked on
bicultural.
And bicultural. So he asked on Facebook, you know, does anybody know a black barber, somebody who can cut black hair? And this guy says, oh, yeah, I'm totally, totally familiar with it. And he went, and I think what the guy was totally familiar with was cutting permed hair, and just kind of assumed.
No, I know you keep saying that, but I'm telling you, no. This guy does not know how to cut curly hair at all.
Okay.
At all. I know you think that perms create uniform lengths in the curls, and it does not. If you stretch out curly hair when you're cutting it, you're going to not have, because each curl has different elasticity, even when permed.
Okay.
Even when permed.
I've never had a perm, just...
Yeah,
you know,
your hair is straight as a bone, except for your beard hair. I think your beard hair, to me, though, is kind of more frizzy than curly.
It is not frizzy. It is crinkly.
I know you think crinkly, but I think frizzy and brittle.
It is not brittle.
Your beard hair is dry as a bone. And can the mic pick up you stroking your beard hair?
No, it can't. I've checked multiple times.
Okay, because you're just going to town today.
Oh, absolutely.
Just like, my precious, my pretty.
No, it's whenever I stroke it, I become slightly more wise.
Oh, geez. So Ross's timelines are different.
Yeah.
I feel that he grew up much slower in Japan because he didn't have as many social points of contact. And so we were really able to craft and shape who his peers were.
Yeah, I think
and that, for I think the that's most a big part, thing. From 12 to, I want to say, geez Louise, till about 17 or 18.
Yeah.
His peers were either college students who were playing Go.
Right.
Or people in their 60s who were playing Go.
Yeah.
Because that was almost his only source of socialization was the board game Go. It's the one with it's a logic game with white and black stones.
Well, he did soccer too.
On a triangle board. Yeah, but he didn't do soccer for very long.
No, I think we.
And was then like 9 months, he maybe. Did soccer, it was mostly Brazilians who spoke Portuguese.
Right.
So they spoke Portuguese and Japanese.
Yeah.
And then...
And his Japanese was not that good at that time, so it was limited communication.
Yeah. So we didn't get him involved in any serious soccer teams because he wasn't really athletically skilled.
No. That wasn't his talent. Most of the sports happen through the schools, through the club system in schools. So if you don't go to a school, it can be really tough to be involved in things here in Japan as a young person.
So then when he was about... 18, 19, he got into salsa dancing.
Yep.
And then started socializing with different people in dance clubs and the salsa community. And also, we talked about it on a Making Friends thing, with like the Nagoya Adventure Club and different Facebook groups and meetup groups. And so his socialization felt really easy and his development felt really easy because he moved out on his own at 20. He didn't get a car until he was 25.
And I think it was easier. I think part of the reason is that is Japanese bars. So in the U.S., if you wanted to learn that, you'd probably go to a bar and you'd probably have to be 21 to enter.
Yeah.
But in Japan, there's no age limit on entering a bar because of like a centuries old law that basically it's not legal to serve only alcohol.
Yeah.
So every bar is actually a restaurant.
Yeah.
Where all ages are welcome. So if I go to a bar, it's not unusual to see kids there. They're not drinking, but they're there, you know, eating food with their parents while their parents drink or not. But
or they're on their own.
Or they're on their own.
We do see, you know, youngsters out on dates at restaurants and such.
Yeah. So yeah, I think it did alter his timeline as far as raising him. And I think that some of the parts were easier. So before we moved, we had to drive him to any activities or have one of his friends' parents pick him up.
Yeah.
Unless they were really close by. I think he had a couple of friends he could ride his bicycle to their house. But that was like very limited number of people.
Yeah.
But being here in Japan, you know, as long as he knew the subway and train route, he could go pretty much anywhere.
Yeah. And so he was able, he had a lot of autonomy. I think he had more autonomy at a younger age.
Yeah.
Because at around 13, he was just riding the subway all over wherever he wanted to go. He would just tell us where he wanted to go and leave.
Right.
Whereas in the United States at 13, because of where we lived, you would have to drive him.
Yes.
And so he would have autonomy at the destination, but maybe not autonomy getting to and from.
Right.
And because we were in Japan and we lived so close to public transportation, there were many days that he would go hang out at the Ki'in or the Igobun, Go Club on Nagoya campus, Nagoya University campus, or hang out at the Go Parlor. There was his favorite local Go Parlor here in
Nagoya. Yeah, there were several, but he had one favorite. He was a member, so he got discounted entry and all of that. So, yeah.
Yeah, and then when he started going out to clubs, I think he had a lot more leeway at 16 and 17 because he could stay out until the last train.
Right.
And then...
which is at about midnight.
Yeah, because last train's at midnight. And so I'm not sure that midnight would have been his curfew in the United States. I don't know if I would have felt comfortable with him driving around at midnight.
Yeah, I don't remember the California laws on that because I know California has laws about how late teenagers can be driving and whether they can have passengers and all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. And so then around 18, 19, we just sort of just text us and let us know if you're catching the last train or not.
Yeah.
And so sometimes he would come in 6 o'clock the next day when the train started again.
Mm-hmm.
And I know now that he lives on his own, sometimes he will just walk home after the last train.
Right.
Stop. Because he has friends that live in and around his neighborhood that he sometimes goes out with. But since he's got his car, he doesn't tend to do that anymore.
Yeah. Well, because there's a lot of 24-hour entertainment in Japan.
Yeah.
But it's not always entertaining to do that for 6 hours. So most karaoke places are open 24 hours.
Yeah.
There's, you know, internet
several 24-hour
internet cafes that are open 24 hours. Yeah, some restaurants and things. But it's, you know, not necessarily fun to go to karaoke for 5 hours unless you're with somebody you're really having a good time with.
Yeah. And something I really like that makes it easier to be happy about him owning a car is he's not really a drinker.
Yeah.
So he has gotten drunk. And the first time he got drunk was at home with me. So mm-hmm. I wanted him to, we didn't get hammered together, but I wanted him to see what a small amount of alcohol it takes to not fully be yourself.
Yeah. It was like, okay, drink this. Okay. Now how are you feeling? Okay. That's called buzzed. You're feeling buzzed. Okay. Yeah. Drink this. Okay. Now you're tipsy.
So we did three drinks. We did vodka orange juice with a half shot of vodka.
Mm-hmm.
And then we did a mudslide, which is a ton of alcohol. It's vodka, Kahlua and milk, Bailey's and cream, mm-hmm. and milk. And the reason that I wanted him to do those two mixed drinks specifically is because the mudslide just tastes delicious. You don't taste any of the alcohol. It's sweet and creamy and good. And when you're first drinking it, you don't feel buzzed.
Yeah. Now, that's your personal opinion. I think it's vile. But I dislike the taste of coffee.
Yeah, so it's not because of the alcohol. You don't like the two coffee liqueurs that are included.
Correct.
And then after he drank that, he was like, oh, I'm feeling good. And I was like, okay, now get up and move around.
Uh-huh.
Let it circulate. And he's like, okay, I'm buzzed. And I'm like, yeah, two mixed drinks most often will get, who's very small in frame and doesn't drink often, so most likely get him buzzed. I said, now let's put a shot of vodka on top of that so you can be drunk.
Yeah.
And he was able to see, okay, if I drink one drink, go dance, and then drink a second drink 30 minutes later, I'm going to stay even all night. If I'm drinking drinks back to back, I'm going to get drunker than I mean to. And there has been times that he has gotten, there's been two occasions that he's gotten so drunk that he had the spins.
Yeah.
But he wasn't driving either of those times. And he intended to go out and have a good time and see what it felt like to get hammered, just to experiment, and he didn't like the aftermath of it.
Yeah, so he's never been a fan of the nomihodai, which nomihodai is the all you can drink.
Yeah,
it says you pay a set price, and for 2 hours they'll bring you as much booze as you can stomach.
Yeah,
it's usually watered down, but you can still get really, really drunk on it, and it's a thing here in Japan. So
yeah, so I wasn't worried about drug use so much in Japan because drugs are really hard to come by
mm-hmm.
in Japan, and there's such strict drug laws that even if you are under the influence, it is still considered the word just ran out of my head, possession. So yes. Having it in your system is possession in Japan.
Yes.
And we always told him, you know, if you're with someone who's doing drugs or you're around drugs, know that if you get secondhand smoke from marijuana and then you get arrested, they will do a blood test on you, and that blood test will show that you have marijuana in your system, and then you will get possession and you may be deported. But
yeah,
your
Japanese friend is going to get a slap on the wrist.
Yes.
You are going to have major, major consequences.
Yes. And so for him, if we know of an expat that smokes, we tell him, hey, they're a smoker. Make sure that they're not smoking around you.
Yeah.
Because I'm not judging. They can choose to take that risk. I'm not taking that risk.
Well, and when I was at Nagoya University, apparently mushrooms were popular.
I
saw several signs and buildings that would say, do not go into the woods looking for mushrooms. if you eat mushrooms, you might hallucinate, but you will die. And yeah, if you're a foreigner, we will deport you. So yeah, most of the mushrooms were poisonous.
Yeah.
And they'd had, I think, 5 or 6 deaths from people thinking they were getting hallucinogenic mushrooms, getting poisonous mushrooms instead.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, there are drugs in Japan, but it's a lot less, and it's a lot less obvious.
Yeah. And so with the drinking, I was just really, really happy that he's not a heavy drinker because he has porphyria. He inherited hereditary corporal porphyria from me. And he also inherited lupus from me. And both of those cause inflammation and irritation. And so if he drinks, he's going to have issues with his pancreas, issues with his liver. So I'm really, he can metabolize it okay, but afterwards it just really leaves him feeling sick. So I'm super, super happy that he's not a heavy drinker. He's just all around a really responsible dude.
Yeah. Now, if you're listening and you like to drink and you don't have a drinking problem, you know, good on you. But yeah, for all three of us, it's physically bad. It lowers my threshold for seizures, and for you and Rasta, it causes problems with porphyria and lupus. So
yeah, and my pancreas can't take it. I was a hard drinker for years and years and years, and
yeah, like, before your diagnoses.
Yeah, before my even if I had a diagnosis, let's be real. Before I had Rasta. And the first 5 years of Ross's life, there would be like, I'd drop him off with a caregiver for the weekend and I would go party. Not every weekend, but well, I still enjoyed the drink.
I know that when you were doing sex work, you would drink a lot too.
Yeah. Sex work, I did drink a lot and do a lot of drugs. It wasn't because I was doing sex work. It was because the environment I was in had a lot of alcohol.
Yeah.
And so when I was a stripper in the bar, I made money off of getting people drunk.
Yes.
So, you know, people don't like to drink alone. And if you have a high tolerance for alcohol, you make more money than the girls that don't
drink. Yeah, talking with you, I learned all about dancer drinks and all kinds of things because I had never been to a strip club.
Yeah. And I told you, yeah, no, I'm ordering diet today. And you're like, what's a diet? It's watered down alcohol so that I'm not drinking as much. And like the more savvy people would be like, give me her drink. And so to see if I was drinking diet drinks or if I was drinking fully loaded. And then there was a whole list of
I don't know if I'd call that savvy, but
the more experienced.
I would say predatory, but you know.
Okay. So yeah, but there's no sex in the champagne room.
No.
There's no sex in the champagne room, for reals. So anyways, that's like a huge digression. So I don't even know if we talked about raising a kid in Japan.
Yeah, we did. We put him in college because we didn't want to put him in high school because we didn't want him set on fire.
Yeah.
He had more
lots of foreign people go to Japanese high school and are completely fine.
Yeah.
Don't get picked on, don't get bullied, and have a lovely experience.
He had a lot of autonomy. And he didn't get given your car.
Which is hard for me.
Those are the three things if you want to raise a kid in Japan. Don't give them Kiss for his car. Give them some autonomy.
Well, and so for language, I think I do want to touch on how he learned Japanese. Because that is something people ask me a great deal.
Yes.
How did his Japanese get to be so good? For he went to a family Japanese class at Nagoya University for 2 years.
Right. While I was there, both Christopher and Rasta were able to attend a family Japanese class.
Yes. And that was once a week.
Yeah.
And then he went to the Go clubs and played Go with only people who could speak Japanese. So he would practice his Japanese speaking there.
Right.
Then he went from there to the YWCA in Nagoya. There, I think he went to the 5-day-a-week program first.
Yeah, he did.
And he did the 5-day-a-week program for about 6 months.
Yeah, so the YWCA is the Young Women's Christian Association. It's like the YMCA, but for women.
Yeah.
But for some reason, they're a language school here. They do other stuff, but
they're
primarily a language school.
And social school.
And they teach both Japanese and English.
Yeah. I think they have some other private lessons for different languages.
Yeah, I think so. But their main programs are teaching Japanese to non-Japanese people and teaching English to Japanese people.
And then after doing about 6 months of that, I think he went to the 2-day-a-week for about 6 months. So he did like probably like a year at the YWCA.
I think he did 2 years overall.
Okay. So he had he was doing different plans at different frequency.
And he met different people who would invite him out to events. And usually they were older people.
Yeah. And then joining the salsa community, he spoke to a lot of people, but his Japanese really took off when he started dating.
Yeah.
And that really solidified, I think, more so his reading, because he wasn't studying kanji,
you know,
and
for
now
reading,
he does line on kanji.
For reading, he has always been motivated by what does it get me.
Yeah.
So he learned to read English because Pokemon came out.
Yeah. And if he wanted to play Pokemon, I wouldn't read him anything that it said.
Yeah, it was Pokemon and it was Tomba on the PlayStation.
Yeah. And we would not read what it said to him. And he's so stubborn, man, because Pokemon came out when he was 5.
Right.
And he was like, I'm going to play it anyways. And I'm like, go ahead. I'm not reading this.
Mm-hmm.
And it was through frustration not being able to do what he wanted.
Right.
And it wasn't until I started playing Pokemon and he was seeing all the stuff I could do that he couldn't do.
Yeah.
Because he thought that he was maxing out the game with his little bit of knowledge, being stuck in the first town.
Okay.
Not knowing how to do anything. He didn't even realize there were other towns.
That they were telling him, go to the next town over.
Yeah.
I'm skipping the boring part.
Yeah, because he would just walk in and out of all the rooms. And so he ended up getting a random starter Pokemon
right. Just
by fluke. And, oh, I'm in a battle. Okay, I'm just going to push buttons. So when he saw everything I could do, then it was like, okay, if you're serious about learning to read, then let's read this.
And I will say that my own Japanese reading improved greatly when I started playing Japanese video games.
And my Japanese reading is still busted.
Because you don't play bills. Japanese video games.
Yeah, no, I can read bills.
Yeah.
I can read about 75% of our bills. It's like 25% that I can't read.
The ones that don't come regularly. Yeah.
Yeah. That are a little bit of a struggle for me. So, yeah, that's why he was motivated, because then he was doing, then Line came out and he was receiving a lot of text messages
right.
in Japanese. And so now his Japanese reading is quite good.
Yes.
So how to get bilingual and biliterate.
Get involved in something social. I know a lot of people who've learned Japanese through watching home dramas.
Yeah.
So they always sound very dramatic when they speak. And then there's the guys who learn Japanese from their girlfriends.
Yeah, and they sound effeminate.
They sound effeminate when they speak.
Because Japanese does have a masculine expression and feminine expression.
There's people who learn at university, so I sound very uptight when I speak.
Yeah.
So.
And my Japanese is level busted, so I sound very halting and hesitant when I speak.
Yeah.
There are like a few phrases that just roll off the tongue for me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because people come to my office, chotomate kusai.
Yeah, which is please wait.
Yeah. So that just rolls off. And then saying, you know, this is a business. I don't live here. I'm with clients now. Please do not come back.
Mm-hmm.
I am always busy. No, I do not want whatever you're offering.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, the stuff that you say often.
I don't want any residual income.
That's not who comes to my door. Jehovah's Witness
come. Jehovah's Witness come, yeah.
And sometimes a door-to-door salesman come.
Yeah.
Every once in a while.
Yeah.
Because my building is not, it doesn't have a security entrance. You can't just walk up to the individual units.
Yeah, I accidentally let in a door-to-door salesman once, and he was trying to sell us filters for our stove. And I was like, but don't you love your wife? Not want her to have to clean it? I was like, first of all, yes, I do love my wife. Second of all, I'm the one who cleans that. So, goodbye for you.
Yeah. So, for me, I feel like raising a kid in Japan to be bilingual and biliterate just takes effort and intention.
Yeah, I think so.
And I think everyone should find their own way.
I think it would have been very similar to raising him in someplace like New York City, where there's ways to get around on your own.
I don't think so, because in New York City, I doubt that you're seeing 5-year-olds riding the subway by themselves.
Okay, yes. Maybe not New York City, but maybe one of the European cities with good transportation.
And low crime,
yeah.
Where it's safe for kids.
Yeah.
So I'm really happy of our choice to move him when he was 12. I really love the fact that he can culture switch.
Yeah.
And I really love the fact that at 25, he's completely biliterate, completely bilingual, and completely bicultural, because that means that he'll be able to, I'm always thinking about my grandbabies, he'll be able to celebrate both parts of my grandbabies. The Japanese
Your future
part,
grandbabies.
Yeah, my future grandbabies. He doesn't have any kids yet. So that he'll be able to celebrate their Japanese and American heritage and their African-American heritage.
Mm-hmm.
All that they bring to the table, because I think in a lot of international couples that we see, the foreign partner doesn't celebrate Japanese holidays,
right?
Doesn't celebrate Japanese traditions. And I think they're kind of missing a really great opportunity of embracing and celebrating all that their child is.
Yeah. So that's us.
Yeah, that's us for today. Thanks for listening. Hope you tune in again next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you for listening. You can keep the conversation going on our website at themusicsinjapan.com. That's the music spelled M-U-S-I-C-K-S. Be sure to follow us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at The Musics on both.
And if you'd like to support us, please visit our website to sign up for our newsletter, join a Patreon tier, or send us a one-time donation through PayPal or Ko-fi. We hope you'll listen again next week.
Bye.